This is Stella Peroni interviewing Phyllis Faber on September 9th in the morning. Okay, Phyllis, tell me about your parents or your family.
Okay, well, my father was born in Oakland, California. His father, my grandfather, had emigrated from Scotland to Oakland, and there was a large group of Scottish people that lived in Oakland at that time. I think my grandfather's parent always hosted a big party at Christmas time, Hogmanay Day. And so, anyway, he grew up in Oakland. His father died shortly after the earthquake, and I remember tales of they're having to move the stove out of the house because of the earthquake and surround it with cardboard on the street in Oakland so that they could cook outside. And his father died fairly soon after that. And when he was growing up, his mother had a friend in Oakland, and she would send my father to their ranch in Sonoma County in the summertime so that he could become manly. There would be, you know, manly things going on the ranch, and that would be a good thing for my father. And so amazingly, in later life, I met the man that owns that ranch, Crawford Cooley, and he's become a very dear friend of mine. So it's sort of a wonderful rounding of the circle. But anyway, my father married my mother, who came from the East Coast, and they lived in Oakland for some time, a short number of years, and then he went back east for his business career, but always told us when we were children of tales of California and camping up in the Sierras and these wonderful, wonderful tales. So our lives were filled with the beauties of the Sierra and summers camping. And during the Second World War, the son of the best man at my parents' wedding came east from Oakland to go to the European Theater and met my sister. And after the war, when he came back, they were married. They corresponded all during the war. So my sister came out to San Francisco in 1946 has lived out here to the end of her life. Her name is Pat DeFremery, and she's lived in Mill Valley since 1950 up on Lovell Avenue. And my parents retired. When they retired in 59, they bought the house from Tom Stone down on Cascade, and they lived in that for the rest of their lives. They both died in that house. The house, 130 Cascade, had belonged to Tom Stone, and I think the year after my father died, in 1981, I think that house was 100 years old. He was looking forward to celebrating the 100th anniversary of that house, 130 Cascade. So it was sad for all of us that he died before that celebration.
Who was Tom Stone?
Tom Stone was a physician here in Mill Valley. He was a well-known physician. He lived here for many, many years. And I'm not quite sure why he sold the house. I think it needed a lot of repairs, and he just wanted something newer. I think he had had, I think his wife died, Virginia Stone, who was a botanist. She died sometime after, she died in the early 70s because Tom made a donation to the California Native Plant Society to provide books, botany books, for the Mill Valley Library, and so they have some books in that library that were purchased on behalf of Virginia Stone.
Phyllis, what were your parents' names? Because Faber is your maiden.
Is my your, name, is yeah. It was Paul and Marjorie Kidd, K-Y-D-D. And my sister's name was Pat DeFremery.
Okay. Where was the Cooley Ranch?
Oh, the Cooley Ranch is up in Sonoma and Mendocino. It's a very large ranch. At one time, it was 22,000 acres. There have been additions to it as it has been developed. It was owned by the Cooley family, and when my father was sent there, it was managed by Charlie Cooley, who later died, and his brother really owned it. His brother was a lawyer for Mayor Rolfe in San Francisco. And so they put this ranch together over the years. The latest addition to the ranch was the result of the construction of the Warm Springs Dam up in Sonoma. And they had to condemn quite a bit of the acreage of the Cooley Ranch in order to create that reservoir. And so the Cooley Ranch was expanded at that time. So it's just a very, very beautiful ranch, and interesting how the owner of it and I became friends at a much, much later
time. Just coincidentally you became friends?
Well, we became friends because he was the first addition to the newly established and functioning malt board. And we needed to expand the board, and somebody proposed somebody named Crawford Cooley. So when he joined our board, I said to him, do you know somebody in Sonoma? Do you know of a ranch in Sonoma, a Cooley Ranch? And he said, well, I have one. And so it turns out that that indeed was the very ranch that my father was sent to as a boy. So so I was absolutely blown away by actually meeting the man. And so he took me up to see the ranch. And at that time, I was eagerly learning all of the names of all the wildflowers of California, and he's always been interested in the flowers. So for the next several years, we spent making a plant list for that ranch, and spent a lot of time each spring. And even to this day, he sees something that he thinks isn't on the list, and he will bring me down a specimen of the plant to make sure it's on that plant list. So it's just been a lot of fun for me, for both of us, really.
Wow. Yeah. Did he remember your father?
No, he didn't, because he wouldn't have been at the ranch when my father, years that my father was there. He did come to try to meet him, but it was when my father was dying, and he happened to come on a bad day, so he didn't get a chance to meet him. So I was always sorry about that, but... what a remarkable coincidence and sort of closing of a circle.
Yeah. How old is Crawford today, roughly?
He's 2 years older than I am. He's 87. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Hey, tell me about 130 Cascade after your parents moved on.
Well, when my mother died, we obviously needed to do something about that house.
What year was this?
This was in 1984. So we spent close to a year repainting and fixing the house up in order to put it onto the market. And when the family that really wanted the house said, oh, they just wanted that house so badly. And so we thought, well, they are the family that should have the house. And in many ways, I am glad because they have, as a family, enjoyed it. But what is interesting and what is disappointing is that my sister and I had decided we would not put it in a historic, under historic...
Overlay,
because the kitchen really needed to be remodeled, and we were afraid that it would inhibit whoever bought the house about remodeling the kitchen. So we declined doing that. And after we sold this family the house, they really didn't have enough money to support the house, so they lifted the house up off the ground and put a floor under it, a unit under it, a rental unit under the house, and they destroyed the architectural design of the house. And I have so regretted that. I felt that that was unfair to that house to have done it. And then they also, my mother had a wonderful garden, and they cared nothing about gardens, and they drove their cars into the yard and parked the cars on the redwood trees. And I've asked them to do something about it, and I've asked them not to, but I don't own the house anymore. They actually have put stones on the ground, so it isn't quite as severe, but I do worry about parking trees on redwoods. I think it's not healthy for the redwood trees. So I have had some anxieties about them. What I am happy about is that it is a family, and they have raised their children there, and that's wonderful.
Great. Phyllis, when did you come back to Mill Valley?
We came to Mill Valley the first time my parents came here in 59. My sister came in 50. And we came in, I think, 62 or 63.
We is?
Husband and two children, two boys. And my husband worked for Xerox. And so we had been moved around a tremendous amount. And at that time, we were living in Rochester, New York, in the home office of Xerox. And so we were asked if we wanted to go to Washington, D.C. or to San Francisco. So there was zero choice in that. We were thrilled to come to San Francisco. So we moved to Mill Valley in 1962 or 3, and we bought a house out at the end of the golf course on Vista Linda. And we were there for 3 years.
Do you remember the number?
I don't think I do.
Okay.
It's the first house. It's the first house when you go through the redwood trees and go around the end of the golf course. It's the first house. I just don't remember the number on the right. But that was the most wonderful neighborhood I think I've ever lived in my whole life. We just became such good friends of everybody there. I still see them to this day.
Who are they?
Well, they were the Jordans. Francie Jordan lived right up the hill. Francie and Larry Jordan and their children that were friends of my children. The Hemingways, Jack and Puck Hemingway, were across the street. The Goldfines were right up the street from us, and we still see the Jordans and the Goldfines. It was a very happy time for us. Living in that house. It was wonderful. So Xerox again moved us in 66. They moved us back to New York, to the headquarters. Ed became the head of their education division. And so we bought a house where my cousin lived in Rowayton, Connecticut. And that was another really happy time for us. We were there for 4 years. And I finished my degree at Yale. And then we came back in 1970. Ed left Xerox, and we came back to Mill Valley in 1970 and lived in John and Betty Girk's house, whom we had known when we lived in Mill Valley before, and they were away in Holland for the year.
Their house up in Marlin?
Yeah, so we lived in that house for a year. We rented it. And then we bought Peter Baer's house at 212, and we've been there ever since, which is now 43 years. So... It's been a wonderful time in Mill Valley for them.
So you lived across the street from the Hemingways on Vista Linda.
I did. Their house was across the street instead of up a hill. And Jack and Puck, and they had two children, three children. Mary Elle was the youngest, and she was exactly son Charlie's age. So they played. I have a marvelous picture of them at a birthday party together. And then Margot was older, and she was in the fourth and fifth grade when we lived there. And I absolutely adored Margot Hemingway. She was such fun. I'd take the kids over to the beach, and Margot would come with us. She was so spirited. I mean, I always remember her opening the window when we were passing a deer and hooting out the window. She was just full of spirit, full of life. She'd come into. We never locked our door. And we were sort of because we were at the bottom of the hill, we were sort of the neighborhood. Everybody would sort of roll down the hill and into our place. And Margot would come in on a Saturday morning, and I would wake up Saturday morning, and Margot would be standing there staring at me, willing me to wake up in the morning.
She was like fourth grade, you said?
She was fourth or fifth grade.
Wow.
I adore her. I think of all the children I've known, she was one of my favorite children. She was so, so full of life, so full of spirit. She was just a remarkable child. And Jack and Puck were lots of fun. Puck was a fabulous cook, so it was always a treat to go to their house for dinner. It was always intimidating to have them come to our house for dinner.
Were they Jack and Puck about your age?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, something on the order.
And Jack was the author's son?
Jack is the oldest son. And Puck had gone to a Cordon Bleu school in Paris with Julia Child. So she was of that type of cook, which was very intimidating for me, but great treat to go up there for dinner. Jack was always fun. Jack, I think, was, I think in his own personal life, I think Jack was troubled. he had difficulties. I remember hearing things. He would come home late at night sometimes, and Puck would be hard on him, and I think he was suffering to some extent. And I think when they had a chance, they moved back to Idaho, which probably was a better place for him than the business that he was in here. I think that didn't suit him wonderfully well. But there were a lot of wonderful times. There were times when his brothers would come, and the Movable Feast was published soon after we came, or soon before we came to that house and got to know them. And so one of the funny things was that they were planning to have a book signing party, because Patrick, one of the younger sons, a different mother than Jack's, could imitate his father's handwriting. So they were going to have a post something book signing of Ernest Hemingway's new book. And there were just really lots of fun times like that. Patrick spent a lot of time in Africa, and I remember walking around our area with him, and his describing how the grasses in Africa looked a lot like the grasses in Marin County. And some years later, when I got to Africa and saw those grasses, I thought, God, I don't agree with that at all. They're just an entirely coarser, more difficult kind of grass. But it was fun talking to him about what Africa was like and all.
Did you ever meet Ernest?
No, he had died.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Yeah. No, he had died before we came. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So you rented the house at Vista Linda, and then
we bought it. We owned it.
Oh, okay. You owned it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And also another person that was a neighbor was Gloria Malvestat. The Malvestats lived just beyond the gold mines. And so she has always been and is to this day a very dear friend of mine that came from 19... We shared an au pair for a couple of years, and Gloria's always been a great friend of mine. So, and it was just a fabulous neighborhood to live in.
Great.
Okay, so while we were living on Vista Linda, we had two little boys, and we adopted a little girl. And it turned out to be such an amazingly wonderful neighborhood project to adopt a little girl. Nobody in the neighborhood had ever had that happen to them. So this was sort of a neighborhood baby.
How old was she?
She was, I think, 3 weeks or three. I mean, she was tiny when she came, and so everybody was just thrilled with this baby. And I had babysitters up the yin yang. Ricky Goldfine would come over, and we would taste test different baby foods, and they would babysit. It was just a great fun project.
How old were your boys when you adopted her?
I think the oldest was 7 and the youngest was 5 or something like that. 6. No, Charlie was 6 and Mitchie was 9. Yeah. So anyway, it was a neighborhood project. I just always remember the neighborhood really, really getting into adopting this baby and how much those kids loved that baby.
Yeah. What was her name?
Carolyn.
Carolyn.
Yeah. So they all wanted to hold her. They all wanted to take her here and take her there. So she had a very busy life.
Were you working at this point?
No. I was home. I was going to school, but...
What were you going to school in?
Well, we had moved so much. I think we'd moved something like 15 times over our married life. And it had been back and forth across the country, and so I really felt like I needed something for me. It was time.
But you already had your bachelor's degree, right, before you got married?
Yeah. So anyway, I went back to school. I started taking courses at San Francisco State and discovered field biology. I had worked in labs when I got out of school. I'd worked at Rockefeller, and I worked at Eli Lilly and ran a hospital lab and so on. So I had had a lot of years of laboratory experience, but I'd never done field biology, which I discovered at San Francisco State, and I just absolutely loved. So and then at the same time, Watson and Crick had just done their thing with DNA, and in the years that I was at Rockefeller, we had been working on the model of DNA in the nucleus and RNA in the cytoplasm. So we kept breaking up cells and then testing the nuclei for DNA and RNA, and we kept finding traces of RNA. So we thought we weren't getting our cells really clean. So we did this over and over and over and over. I can't tell you how many times. And of course, when Watson and Crick came out, that their model was that there was RNA in the nucleus that was the transfer of the information out of the cell to the ribosomes where the proteins are made. So it made absolute sense. And we were just looking at the wrong model for so many years. So I was enthralled by this and so decided that that's what I would get my master's in. Well, then Xerox moved us again, and... So the faculty at San Francisco State happened to have a contact at Yale, and so she arranged for me to go and work in Yale. And so I worked for a year and maintained a culture collection for Dr. Ed Adelberg at Yale. And then the following year, he gave me a little piece of the research he was doing so I could finish my master's. So that's how that worked. But it was a fascinating era in science.
Must have been hard to have 3 small kids when you were doing that.
Well, we had a wonderful Jamaican that came and lived with us, so she took care of Carolyn, so that was all right. But it did mean that I couldn't really go into laboratory-type work because those are long days, and you really have to just be devoted to it. So it changed the course of my life, which I think has probably been a very good thing, because when I finished, I took a job teaching in the school, the private school that was in the community where we were living. And so I could be home after school when the kids came home from school. And so that worked a lot better. And it really sent me off in a totally different direction. And I think for my lifetime, that's probably worked well.
And that's when you got involved in wetland preservation?
That's when I got involved in wetland preservation, because the woman whose job I was taking was named Joy Lee, and her mother had been the mayor of Sydney, Australia. And Joy Lee was a force to contend with. And she said to me, "The world is going to fall apart if we don't preserve wetlands." And so I knew nothing about wetlands. And so the woman that was at Yale in my lab was in charge of Yale's program down in Sapelo Island, Georgia. So I went to her and I said, Barbara, did you know that the world is going to fall apart if we don't save wetlands? And she had no idea. So Joy Lee knew what Yale didn't know. And so anyway, she did really persuade me that I should pay attention to wetlands, learn about them, and should foster the organization she had put together, which was called Protect Your Environment. And so I was at the helm of Protect Your Environment, and it was the year that was the first Earth Day. And so,
what year was that, do you think?
This was in 1970. And so Joy came up at Christmas, and we went to the AAAS meetings, and she made sure I met the people in Washington that were putting on Earth Day. And so I spent that spring working like crazy, putting together an enormous Earth Day. And we rented...
For your town?
For our town, yeah, the school and the town. We rented an enormous tent, and we had a very wonderful program, I must say. All kinds of people, all kinds of interests, all kinds of environmental issues. And it was a very big deal. People still remember it all these years later in Rowayton, Connecticut. But it got me launched into the field of wetlands. So when we did move to California in 1970, I started teaching with a small group of teachers that called Natural Science Education Resources that were interested in natural history. And and so I also was interested in wetlands, so I got involved with the group that was trying to pass coastal legislation. Back in Connecticut, there was a coastal bill. There were three coastal bills. And so I really tried very hard to get the most stringent of those three bills passed in Connecticut. And we, the girls and I, would go and meet people at the train station and say, you know, work on this bill, get them to pass the most...
Wait, who are the girls?
The students at my school. We'd go down and meet trains and pressure people to do the right thing. So anyway, back in Connecticut, in California, I became part of a group that Janet Adams was heading, and they were trying to pass coastal legislation. And Alan Cerruti had a bill fail, and there was a second bill that he was trying to get passed, and it was agreed that if that bill failed, and I think its number was 1475, if that bill failed, that they would put an initiative on the ballot. And Pete Wilson was mayor of San Diego at that time, and he agreed to this. He liked the idea of a coastal initiative, and it's curious that later when he became governor, he didn't like the Coastal Act at all, but he did support it back in 1970, and because he did, Janet Adams had the courage to put this initiative on the ballot, and so I became co-chair for the Marin County effort, and I have to say, I really worked like a dog. I got signatures night and day.
Wow.
And Marin came in with the largest percentage for Prop 20 of any county in California except Yolo County, and that was the Davis students. The Davis students really went all out, and so the two of us really had a tremendous turnout. Well, Peter Beer was our state senator at that time, and so sort of as a reward, he invited me to become a member of the first Coastal Commission, which is what Prop 20 did. It created a Coastal Commission in California.
Okay, now, was this before you bought his house? How did that work?
It was before.
Okay. Was it a coincidence you bought Peter Beer's house?
I'm a little fuzzy on whether... what I was doing. I think I think we bought his house before. It wasn't connected at all. My work wasn't connected with 212 at all. But I think I might have been living there. I really just don't remember.
Okay, good enough. Yeah. I just think it's highly coincidental that you end up buying Peter Bear's house.
It does seem like a coincidence, but it actually had nothing to do with Prop 20.
Okay, so anyway, Peter Bear got you on the Coastal Commission.
So he invited me to join, through the Senate Rules Committee, he invited me to join the Coastal Commission. And that has always been an extraordinary experience. It was intimidating for me. It was sort of overwhelming to me to be on such a commission.
Was that like a full-time job?
No. There were meetings just once a month.
Okay. There a lot of prep work to do for them?
Two or three. There was a lot of prep work and a lot of visiting the sites and so on, looking to see what the projects were. There was a lot of pressure. In those early days of the commission, people felt very free calling you. Urging you to vote one way or another on an issue. So,
what were some of the issues you addressed when you were on the Coastal Commission?
Oh, well, there were a lot. Some of the ones that I can remember were, there was a man that had purchased there was a former business partner of Bill Strauss.
Of the dairy?
Yeah. Herb Angress had been a partner of Bill's. He had become a partner, hadn't brought any money into the partnership, but became a partner and worked for a number of years. And when Bill wanted to break up that partnership, he gave Herb Angress 100 acres of land as thanks and, as fair breaking up the partnership. Well, Herb Angress tried to develop a campground because he thought that, this was sort of the end of the 60s and hippies were the big thing. So he proposed a campground on a piece of this 100 acres that was on the inboard side of Highway 1 on the edge of Tomales Bay. And the county freaked out about having a campground with hippies. So they turned down Herb Angress's project. And so then he thought, oh, all right, well, if the county doesn't want that, then we'll have a motel. So he made plans for a motel, and he sited it on the ocean side, on the bay side of Highway 1. Well, of course, in the meantime, the Coastal Act passed, and the Coastal Act prohibits anything from Highway 1 out to the water edge. So when this came up to the Coastal Commission, it was extremely interesting because Michael Warnham, as a supervisor, had voted for the Angress Motel. Margaret Azevedo, as the head of the Planning Commission, had voted for the thing. But now both of them, as coastal commissioners, which they both were, they voted against it because they could see it didn't conform to the Coastal Act. So I was really proud of both of them. And Herb Angress's project went down in flames. So that was interesting. There were some wonderful projects. There was a we had a commissioner named Wanda Zankich who owned the Tides restaurant up in Bodega, and she was a wonderful woman. She was fairly inarticulate, but she absolutely supported the fishermen. And so Wanda always spoke up when there were issues of fishing that would come up. She would always stand up for the fishermen. So our commission made possible for the dock up in Bodega Bay to be built, and that was always a wonderful project. We had some silly projects. There were projects in San Francisco. Our commission covered San Francisco, Marin, and Sonoma. And some of the silly things. We had projects in San Francisco where there were some Irish contractors that were there, and they wanted to build, they wanted to remodel houses or build houses. And so it got into issues like, would the new house create shade on a neighbor's house and so on? This was stuff that we should just absolutely not have been dealing with. And eventually all of that kind of permit was taken away from the commission, which was a good thing. Some of the interesting things like the steep ravine cabins. There were owners that owned the steep ravine cabins, and when GGNRA was created, that ownership went to the federal government. Is that right? Or the state?
I think it might be the state. I think because you called the state campgrounds to make reservations.
Yeah, okay. So that makes better sense. Yeah. So it went to the state. And so the state came, and that's correct. The state parks came and applied to tear down the steep ravine cabins. And because the Coast Commission had low and moderate cost housing as one of the things that was to be preserved, we turned down tearing down the steep ravine cabins. So then the state parks came back and said, ah, and they came back with a proposal to build them all up to code, which was prohibitively expensive. So we turned that down. And then they came back with what we have today, which is just so terrific. They were low cost, no electricity, no running water, and the public has really enjoyed that.
Wait,
facility.
Okay, so what was the cabins there today were built after this decision?
The cabins were there. They were owned by individuals, and the state took them
over.
Okay,
I understand now.
Yeah, the state took them over, and so what to do about them? And the state parks first wanted to tear them down, then they wanted to build them into castles, and then they finally got it right.
Okay, and so they just kind of kept them as they were, but took out the electricity? Or did they have electricity?
They didn't have electricity. Okay. They made them what they are today. No electricity, no running water. I think they got it right. Yeah, finally. But that was the kind of issue that the Coastal Commission has dealt with, and what has been really thrilling was that. There was one state commission and six regional commissions, and Joe Botovitz, who was the first executive director, created a plan delineating 10 different areas of planning interest: the marine resources, the coastal energy siting, coastal highways. There were 10 elements to the planning effort, and all six commissions and the state made plans for their part of the coast that covered these 10 areas. And there were hearings for each of the 10 elements in each of the six commissions. So if you multiply three hearings, one in for our North Central Commission, one in San Francisco, one in Marin, and one in Sonoma, three hearings for each of the 10 elements, that's 30 hearings at minimum, times six regions plus the state, the 19, and then all of this was put together in one plan and sent back to the legislature in 1976, and that's what the 1976 Coastal Act was built on. And when it all went back to the legislature, it was the same legislature that couldn't pass the Coastal Act before. The local governments, no local government wants a regional agency to tell them what to do or not to do. So they were still against it. And the local governments didn't want anybody interfering with their power. So there was a hostile audience up in Sacramento for the 1975 plan that went back to them. And Willie Brown got people in a room and he said, you know, we will pass a plan. So that is the Coastal Act that we have that Mel Lane, who was chair, said, "This is an impossible act we have been given, and we will make it work." So it has worked, certainly not perfectly ever since, but at least there is some coastal regulation along California's coast.
Great.
Yeah.
So how long were you on the Coastal Commission?
I was on for probably, it was 3 years until 70, and then I was on for another 6 years, I think. I was the chair for 2 years, and eventually I was knocked off the commission. I was appointed to the to be on the state commission, and our new state senator Barry Keene knocked me off the commission because I hadn't supported him in his election. I supported Gary Giacometti, and so you know Peter Baer had never told me what a political spot I was in. He was such a wonderful person. And he never said, "Phyllis, you're in a very political role." So I never thought about it. So when Gary said, "Would I support him to run for Senate?" I said, "Sure," and not understanding what a stupid thing that was. So I shot myself in the foot.
But wouldn't you have still supported Gary Giacometti? I mean, do you regret that move, supporting him?
I could have just stayed private, and I would have been knocked off the commission. Yeah. You live and learn. So I was off the Coastal Commission and at the same time, I had formed a little consulting company called Madron Associates, but I think I'd like to just talk a little bit about the impact of the Coastal Commission on the formation of MALT, because Ellen Strauss and I had this wonderful idea, but it really would have been a very long shot for our wonderful idea to have taken hold in the world of politics. I'm from East Marin and a biologist. That certainly doesn't give me any cachet with the agricultural world at all, nor with the political world. Ellen was the wife of a rancher, fat Jewish woman. The two of us, I mean, who'd have thought that we could form an organization that would have served the county as well as it has? And I think that the reason that it worked was at the time that we proposed this idea, it just was coincidental that the county was having to create a coastal element for their general plan, and that's what the 1976 law required each city and each county along the California coast to create a coastal plan that would be embedded in the local general plans for the counties and cities. And so Marin was in the middle of doing that in the late 70s, and they were having a hard time because Marin has a lot of agricultural land. The downzoning for A60 to A60 that had occurred several years before, in the 73, I think, something in that era, had been extraordinarily controversial, hugely controversial, and so the idea of further downzoning as required by the Coastal Commission was causing the supervisors to have panic attacks. Because it wasn't just from A60 to A70, it was to 120 or 240 that the Coastal Commission was talking about. This was and the worst of it was that there was the coastal line went right down the middle of the agricultural land in the county. So one side would remain A60 because it would have been out of the coastal zone, whereas the other side of this line would have been A120, and creating huge inequity in the ag community. So the supervisors really were facing a situation they just simply didn't know how to deal with. And so at that time, Ralph, the people that were involved in Ellen and my meetings about forming a land trust were Gary Giacomini, the supervisor, Jerry Friedman, the head of the Planning Commission, and Ralph Grossi, who was head of the Land Use Committee for the Farm Bureau. Those were the three people that were dealing with this. And so at that point, Ralph said to the other two, well, maybe the idea of a land trust would get us off this road and we won't have to do this dividing and downzoning half the county. So that really, that was the push that made them accept the idea of Malt as a land trust. So.
October 4th, Stella Peroni talking to Phyllis Faber.
So the County Board of Supervisors chose to try out the land trust instead of downzoning in the county. So we set about putting together a land trust, and it was the first agricultural land trust in the nation. So there were no examples to follow. The Trust for Public Land recommended a really wonderful lawyer who helped us set up the 501c3 aspects of it. And Ralph Grossi was extremely helpful.
Was he the lawyer, Ralph?
No, Ralph Grossi was the Farm Bureau person, the rancher, that sort of said, let's try a land trust instead of downzoning. So anyway, he and Ellen and I got together to choose the first board of directors for Malt. And that has always been interesting to me because we did it so carefully and we chose such wonderful people. We chose very well-respected, conservative, wonderful ranchers from West Marin. And then we chose a person from the Coastal Conservancy, actually, that was a land trust kind of person. We chose Rod Martinelli, who was a lawyer for many of the ranchers, because they would have confidence in him. And so our first board was very carefully chosen, and we would meet in Ralph's father's the little house on his ranch. I'll always remember meeting there. It was great fun. And so little by little, we got started. The ranchers in West Marin, of course, didn't think anything of Malt. We made no headway for quite a while with the ranchers because they could see no purpose in it. The first easement that we did was with a ranch that had a huge amount of debt with a feed company. And they were about to go under because of this large debt. So we put an easement on their property. Ralph organized this easement, pulled it together. So that was exciting that we had number one easement, but the ranchers certainly didn't buy in. We turned down Bill Nyman and Orville Schell down in Bolinas, because they had bought a big piece of property on the edge of the coast, and they wanted to raise pigs. But we turned them down because we were so nervous that Bolinas, with its reputation of being sort of hippies and so on, would confirm in the ranchers' mind, the mainstream ranchers, that Malt was to be avoided. It wasn't until Willie LaFranchi came along, and he was on our board, actually, and he was one of the most respected ranchers out in West Marin. And his neighbor died. She had a property that Willie could see out his bedroom window. He could look at it from his bed, and he'd always wanted to own this ranch. So he said, oh, I wonder, so if he put easements on his ranch, took the money, and purchased his neighbor's ranch with an easement, Malt would give him enough money to buy it with what he got from the easement on his ranch together with what he got for the easement on the neighbor's ranch, he could buy it. So he did. And so that changed Malt's history, because Willie, when he did that, other ranchers said, "Wow, if Willie did that, then maybe we should consider it." So it's a wonderful story. We have, little by little, and in time we hired staff. We had enough money. Oh, I will say that the San Francisco Foundation, that later became the Marin Community Foundation after that terrible lawsuit, and the State Coastal Conservancy, they both funded us and helped Malt get started. And I've always been grateful to them, because they just had faith in us, liked the idea, and they gave us money. So it got us through. So anyway, eventually we hired staff, and the first staff person we hired didn't work out very well, so they didn't stay terribly long, a year or so. And then eventually we hired Bob Berner. And Bob really did a wonderful job with Malt. He was there for, I think, 28 years. And during the course of his tenure, Malt just really made steady progress. And we now, this is now a year after Bob has left, we are now almost up to having easements on 50% of Marin's ag land, which is huge. It gives me great comfort, because I think no court would reverse the easements. The easements are in perpetuity, but nonetheless, I've always been concerned that there could be some legal something that the courts would say, well, you know, we really need to reverse this easement. And then, of course, other easement holders would want to reverse theirs possibly. So anyway, I think when we get over 50% of the land secured, that wouldn't happen. So I'm feeling very good about Malt. And we now have a new executive director, Jameson Watt, whom I like. He's a young man. He and the staff all seem to get along very well. So I think we're off and running. I think we're all very excited. The hard part is, the really hard part for agriculture is two things. One, the value of the land. Somebody that's very wealthy can as easily buy a ranch, a 300, 600-acre ranch, and build a castle on that ranch, which they can do even if there are easements on it. They can have one house on that ranch. And so they can build a castle, and that's a threat to agriculture to have that, to have our land going in that direction. That's not an impetus for healthy agriculture. And the other threat to agriculture is of the park. And the park is, we think, according to the former superintendent, Don Neubacher, they want to get all the ag out of their park. And that's 23% of Marin's agriculture. So that would that could be a very severe blow to our agricultural efforts, because the industry just can't sustain a 23% drop and have the support team, you know, the people that fix machines, the people that sell machines, the people that sell grain, the people that sell anything, still in business with a 23% shrink in the industry.
Why do they want to get the ag out of the park?
I don't know. I think it's a crime, but there are people who crave wilderness. And the concept of wilderness is sort of a romantic dream, in my view. There are roads out there. There are cattle out there. It has been in agriculture for 200 years. So I don't even know what they're talking about with wilderness. The whole of Point Reyes, the whole land mass is not large enough to support a top predator. So it never will be genuine wilderness. There are roads out there. You know, so the people that plead for wilderness, to me, are sort of pleading for a romantic dream. But in the meantime, they're undercutting such a lot of open space and habitat for wildlife in the rest of Marin County that I think they really don't know what they're doing. I really look at them as naive and selfish. So anyway, those are my thoughts about that. So Malt is doing well, and I think we have a lot of enthusiasm. We now have, I think we have the fourth second generation original or early board member on our board. And that's very exciting that the generations are really subscribing to Malt and chipping in to help.
Who's that?
Well, let's see. I think the first one was Sam Dolcini. And then we had Lauren Poncha and Lynn Stray. And we have Sam Dolcini back on the board for the second time. We have Bill Barboni. I think I may be forgetting one person. I can't think of who. Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to go back a little bit. And when we came back out to California and in 1970, I started teaching with a group called Natural Science Education Resources, NSER. And we had a contract to do the program out at Audubon Canyon Ranch, teaching the volunteers about what was at Audubon Canyon Ranch, looking at the birds, and it was quite wonderful. So we had a lot of fun doing that. But out of that I taught a little course in a salt marsh, and Dick Harding from Harding Lawson Soil Consultant called me probably a year, 6 months, a year after I'd been here in California, and said that they needed to have a biological consultant because the CEQA law, the California Environmental Quality Act, had passed, and they had soils engineers, but they didn't have any biologists on their staff, so they wanted somebody that would come and consult with them. Well, I panicked and thought, oh, God. I said to them, you need a PhD, not me. And they said, no, we don't want a PhD. We want somebody like you. So anyway, I got a couple of my friends at NSER to join me, and we formed a little company called Madrone Associates. And Dick Harding and his partner Bob Lawson and a man that had been in the Corps of Engineers, Frank Berger, those three, and Nona Dennis and Remy Kingsley and I each put up a couple $1,000, and we formed this little company called Madrone Associates.
Wait, so did Harding and Lawson leave Harding and Lawson to come, or
no,
they were
no,
working
no,
up
they above? Just they just put money in and you know, gave us office space.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So we started doing environmental impact studies. It was all brand new. I mean, it was very brand new, and we really didn't know what the studies were asking for sometimes. I mean, I think at one point it asked for, I can't even remember the category anymore, but it was something like civil services or something like that. We had no idea what it even meant. So we finally figured, oh, they mean, is there a fire department, or is there a police force? It was just sort of feel your way as we went. Well, anyway, one of my first assignments was to write an EIR for the Golden Gate Bridge District, who wanted to expand their ferry service. And they had looked at a lot of different sites in the Larkspur area. And they had settled on the site that the current ferry, the current Larkspur ferry, is on. We looked at several other sites, but the best site, of course, was out at the bottom of the prison, and the warden of the prison fell apart when he heard that there might be a ferry terminal there, and he said, absolutely not, I'm not about to have boats at the foot of my prison for the prisoners to jump onto. So anyway, it was moved back up the creek, and so I wrote the EIR for that, And so part of the, there was some dredging. There was a kind of a pickleweed island, and there was some dredging that needed to be done. And so as a result, you had to have a mitigation for any damage. And so the mitigation for that project was for the Bridge District to acquire what is called the Muzzy Marsh, which was the big piece of property that went from Larkspur Creek all the way down to the edge of Corte Madera. And part of that was to be kept to put the dredge spoils on, and part of it was to be kept as a marsh restoration. And so that's what happened. And it turned out that it was the largest marsh restoration that had been done so far, of opening the dikes to tidal flow, and no planting, just would the marsh recover on its own. And we had a notion that it would, because there was a culvert inside that came, that drained the marsh, and some cordgrass seed had come through the culvert and was growing inside. So we had a notion that the plants would take hold. And so we didn't have enough money to do anything else anyway. Tom Harvey down in South Bay had been working on a marsh called the Faber Tract, and he had done some transplanting of cordgrass, and it had worked. So we just went ahead and did it, because there really wasn't an alternative for this particular project. So that's how the Muzzy Marsh was created, really, as a mitigation measure. And so when that was done, a year or two years after the property had been purchased and the dikes breached in four places, the marsh was coming back. Amazingly, there was this fine cover of pickleweed in the upper part of the marsh, and the bottom part looked okay. It didn't have any vegetation yet. The city of Corte Madera, there were a couple of people on the city council that said, this isn't what we were promised. We were promised a marsh. And 2 years after the dikes were breached, there was no 100% marsh cover. So they felt that they had been gypped. So they lined Fish and Game up with them and went to the bridge and said, you must dig a trench all the way around the marsh so that there's more water coming in. So I always thought that was punitive and not needed, and I don't think it really was, but anyway, it happened because the Bridge District badly needed to have the ability to dredge the channel out for the ferries. They needed full access for the ferry, so they had to go along with it, and they did that. Well, they hired me to monitor the situation, and after the channel was dug, I noticed that there were some changes that I couldn't explain from a botanical point of view. I really felt we needed a hydrologist, so I called up Phil Williams, who was a hydrologist, and said, I'd really like you to come and look at this and see what you think. So he did, and the two of us got into monitoring wetland restoration projects. And so we monitored the Muzzy Marsh. We took China Camp as our control marsh. And then we monitored Warm Springs down in South in Fremont, because that was another project that Phil had gotten into. And eventually he also was involved in the Sonoma Baylands project, and so I did the monitoring there as well. So we monitored marshes for about 25 years, and have the longest data record. I think it's really very unfortunate with sea level rise coming that those projects are not being followed through. We wrote, the Coastal Conservancy got us to write some guidelines for wetland restoration it was basically done as a kind of a question and answer, and if you could answer all the questions in the affirmative, in this list of questions, then you are almost sure to have a good wetland restoration project. It really led you through the steps that you had to take, the things that you had to do to ensure that you had good channels and things like that. So anyway, we did that, and I think that's a valuable tool for people today. And I wish the monitoring was still going on, because I think with the amount of data that there is in existence, it's too bad not to be watching to see what sea level rise is doing. But funding was really hard to come by. The Marin Community Foundation was very good to us for a lot of years. After I left Madrone, I left Madrone, and the environmental work, I wrote the EIR for the Sulahuli Reservoir and the ensuing bond measure, and that was really too bad to see the end of that project, because Sulahuli was built. When we wrote the EIR, we did a very large cost-benefit study, and it all looked good. It looked like it was going to be worthwhile for the water district to spend the money to build that reservoir, and that they would get water at a reasonable price from the reservoir. Well, 6 months after the reservoir was built, the oil prices, if you remember, that the oil prices just took this huge leap. And so the water district has never pumped water from Sulahuli, I think only once, because it's so expensive to pump. The oil prices are so high. So
how about now that oil prices have, gas prices are probably pumping off gas, aren't they? And gas prices are really low.
I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, I really don't know. I really can't answer that. It's just that I don't think they do. I think they haven't needed to. The water is there, so if they ever needed to, it's there. So I think that's a comfort to them. The net safe yield is always a difficult number to come up with. How much do you actually have in a reservoir? How much can you actually pump out? When will your pipe start drawing water from the bottom of it? All of those things are difficult. So those numbers change all the time. But I don't think they ever have, except for possibly once. And maybe in time they will. Who knows? If we have a very dry year, they might have to. So let's see. What I had done in 1980, when all this wetland work came up, is I decided that what we needed was a field guide for the wetland plants. So I was very involved with the California Native Plant Society at that time, trying to learn all the plants of California. After I left Madrone, I really decided my greatest lack of information was the plants. So I went back, took all the courses over in Berkeley in the botany department, and got to be good friends with Herbert and Irene Baker and with Bob Orndorff, and that has added to my life so much. I put together a book it's a field guide for wetland plants, and I printed it myself because no publisher would print the pages one-to-one. And what I had done was to lay a plant on a page and Xerox it. And so you could take a plant out in the field and put it on the book next to the image that looked like it, and you could be extremely sure that you had the right plant, you had the right marsh plant. So it's a wonderful field guide. So anyway, I published that in 1980, and Orndorff over at Berkeley saw it, and they were looking for an editor for Fremantia, which is the journal of the California Native Plant Society. Marge Hayakawa was the editor. And
is that Senator Hayakawa's wife?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, a really lovely woman. And she wanted to retire. So Bob asked if I would consider taking up the cudgel, which was a huge compliment to me. I thought, oh my God, I'm going to follow Marge Hayakawa. Anyway, I did. I became the editor, and I just loved it. It was a wonderful, wonderful job. I just spent the next, I edited it for 17 years and spent the next 17 years really chasing people around California because I thought it was my job to see that everybody knew what was going on in botany in California. So that was great fun. And not too many years after, and I ended up getting a fabulous designer. She knew nothing about plants. She didn't know one plant from another of any kind, and she became the designer. And over the years, she and I have become such good friends. She's a terrific designer. And about 3 or 4
years... What's her name?
Beth Hansen. Beth Hansen Winter. And so we just did Fremontia at the outset, and so differently from how it's done now. We had pages that had to be pasted up, and it was a very different show. Anyway, somebody had a book that needed to be published, and it was a plant identification book. And so somebody said, you know, you should do that. So Beth and I thought, well, we could probably pull that off. So we did. And it came out very well, and it encouraged us. And so then we started publishing botanical books. And so I formed a press, the California Native Society Press. And I think we must have published, maybe 19, 20 books for them. And finally, they stopped wanting books published, even though we had the book publishing was so successful. We put out little catalogs, and they were charming, and people bought books like crazy. But there was a group in the society that wanted the money that we needed for publishing books to go to conservation projects. And even though we were contributing about a third of the budget by the time all this ended, they didn't want publishing, they wanted conservation. So that publishing effort stopped, and I always thought it was too bad because I think the Native Plant Society has this very special niche for plant books. So I think they made a mistake, chose poorly. I think they think so now too. So, but anyway, what happened was that Bob Orndorff, who was head of the botany department and had been such a, he had been such an ally for me, he really skimmed every article that I, or almost every article that I published in Fremontia, which gave me huge confidence that what I was publishing was accurate and that it was reliable. And so that was just a tremendous gift that he donated to the society. Anyway, he invited me when CNPS decided to stop the publications to join him at UC Press and become co-editor of the Natural History series. So I did, and that was in, that would have been in 1999 or 2000 maybe. And so we were co-editors, and for the rest of his life, he died not too many years after. And I still am. I'm still doing that. So that Natural History series is a terrific series. I think they don't market it very well. People aren't buying books as much as they used to. So it doesn't get the attention and acclaim that it should. But it's a valuable series for the natural history of California's plants and animals. And I mean, my feeling has always been that if people don't know them, if they don't learn them, then they won't care about protecting them. So the series becomes really hugely important to California. But those are my thoughts. I think the marketing department possibly doesn't see it quite as I do. So that's the story of the publishing. I do some publishing outside of UC Press. I've published, just recently I published a book for about the 50th anniversary of the Point Reyes Seashore Park. So I've done other little publishing, but primarily it's been through UC Press. And the only other thing that we have to talk about is my time on the Buck Institute board. Okay, so let's see. I don't remember the year that it was, but at some point, my friend Crawford Cooley called me up and said, would I have lunch? And we talked about an organization called the Buck Institute for Age Research. And it was one of the projects that was set up when the San Francisco Foundation sued to break the trust, the Beryl Buck Trust. They lost in court, and Marin County set up a foundation, the Marin Community Foundation. And in addition, there were three projects created at that time. Each one would get a percentage of the Buck spinoff each year. And so there was one called the Buck Institute for Age Research. And so Crawford invited me to have lunch and talk about Doug Maloney, the county lawyer. What do you call the county lawyer? The solicitor for the county. His involvement on the board of the Buck, and it was causing a lot of confusion. And so I encouraged Crawford to get him to resign because it was only bringing problems. And so sometime after that, he asked me if I would go on the board of the Buck. And so because he was there and because I'd so enjoyed working with him at Malt, he had been the first outside person put onto the board of Malt after the original board. And you know, we were really good friends. We went out looking at his plants every year, making a plant list for his ranch. And so anyway, he asked if I would be interested in going onto the Buck board. Now, I had always been in research when I started my life at Rockefeller and so on, so I was intrigued by a research organization coming to Marin. So I got onto the board. And the organization was just in its formative stage. It wasn't even clear what kind of research or anything. And so there were regular meetings. There were ongoing fights with Novato. It wasn't clear the thing was going to happen at all. They get 15% interest every year from the Buck corpus. The community foundation gets 55%, and these three other organizations, the Buck Institute gets 15, and the other two each get 7, I think, the Education and the Alcohol Institute. Those three are the projects in the county. So I think the Buck, the Community Foundation gets 70%, and the other three get 30%. And the Buck Institute for Age Research gets 15. So anyway, I joined the board and watched the terrible fight up in Novato. They had, before I got on the board, they had purchased a piece of property in Novato, which I think wasn't a particularly wise choice, but Gary Giacomini and Doug Maloney had done this, and I think they didn't really have a great understanding of what a research institute would need or want. And so they just did this and then said, now we're going to have a research institute and put it there. It's never been a terrific site.
Is that the site where they're currently at?
Yeah. Yes, yeah. So the thing kept moving along, and Jack... Oh, Oh, I'll think of his name. He was the director of the Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City. He later went on to be head of Aetna Insurance. He was our guide, really, and was terrific. He was a very enthusiastic, positive person. So eventually it was decided to go forward and have age research as the focus of this institute that was going to be built. And so there was just a lot that went on getting the institute together, getting plans. IMP had already been chosen by the time I was on the board. A lot of difficulties. We hired somebody named Carla D'Angelo. Mary McEachran was the executive director when I got onto the board. Before it was over, she was asked to leave. She really had trouble understanding money, and she was spending us right out of business. So she was asked to leave. We hired Carla D'Angelo, who took us out of the expensive offices that we had and put us into trailers on the site of the institute. And the building was built out of those trailers. We ended up hiring an executive director while we were in Dale Bredesen, who was a researcher at Stanford, or maybe he was the University of Southern California. I think it might have been that. Anyway, he came and has carried on his Alzheimer's research ever since. I became chair of the construction committee, and we hired a contractor to build the building who went bankrupt within 3 or 4 months of starting. That company was bought by another, and they went bankrupt. And in the meantime, what I had as chair of the construction committee, well, we got lucky in that the county had built a jail, and they had hired a man to supervise this jail building. And we hired him. Gary Giacomini really urged us to hire this guy, and luckily we did. And he was terrific. So we also, Carla hired somebody named Ralph, who was the, he still is there. He's just absolutely terrific. And Ralph and the guy from the jail construction together, they got that building built. And I, as chair of the construction committee, will be in awe of them forever, because we had drunken supervisors of the project. We had so many problems with that building. But anyway, it finally got built, and they're beautiful buildings. I question whether it was the wise route to build a research organization to spend so much money on buildings at the outset. If we had moved into warehouses and done our early science in warehouses until we had more money, it might have been wiser. But, you know, it is what it is. So anyway, they're marching forward, and I think they've done a terrific job of saying, yes, we're not in San Francisco, but they do very great interdisciplinary work, and I think the buck is off to a really good start. So we'll see. 20 years from now, we'll know. I won't know, but they will know. So I think that's pretty much where. Okay, so you want to talk about...
saying that it seemed like being the chair of the construction committee wasn't a logical choice.
No,
your background.
A wetland biologist to build that building was the height of folly, but there just wasn't anybody else. I mean, the board had shrunk down. By this time, there were quarrels on the board. It had shrunk to just three members. Fred Drexler, Crawford, and I ended up at one point being the only three members still on the board. And then we expanded the board, but there were people in chair, and Crawford was chair, and Fred Drexler was much older, and he was our financial person. So there really wasn't anybody else to do the construction oversight.
And Phyllis, going back, Crawford was the one that your father worked on, his father. So
right.
That was like a total circle coming
closing
around.
The circle, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Noah's has been wonderful. Yeah.
Okay, really.
But anyway, so I was under no illusion that I was adding much to the pie. But I was able to report back to the board and so on. And eventually, when I think the first buildings were built and opened, and one of the early additions to the board was Art Gensler, who is Gensler Associates, is a world famous architect, and he has been their right hand man ever since, and he's been terrific. He's helped them in so many ways. So so my term as construction chair was short, but it was during a very important time, because that's when the building got built. Art's been there for the subsequent building and for remodeling another one. But the Buck Institute, I think, has a very bright future. And I think they're working very hard to become more integrated with the community, because this community is a community of aging people. So that should be a centerpiece for the community. So we hope they get there.